Hello, my friends. This is Dieter Kalt, your host. And before we get this show going with episode 7, I decided to break it up in two parts because it has been quite a long interview with Ken Thaler, the famous coach. So I hope you enjoy it. Sit back, relax, grab a coffee, grab a beer, take notes, and let's get this thing going. 3, 2, 1, go. Hello, everybody. I am Dieter Kalt. Welcome to 74 once more. This is a show for people who are genuinely about forming successful teams and about coaching. We're teachers, mentors, and leaders and love to assist others in succeeding, but at the same time, are eager to improve the knowledge and skill set to get better every day. So do you want to listen to inspiring stories and learn from the experience of extraordinary people who have been there and done that? Stories of impressive victories, but also about the struggles to overcome one's deepest fears and most challenging resistance and self-doubt. So while today's guest is a prime example of how you can be a coach, a teacher, a mentor, a terrific leader all at the same time, he's an author, an educator, an Olympic ice hockey coach, and specializes in guiding teams, leaders, and coaches through transformational change. He aids them in meeting their issues, challenges, and opportunities as they go through the trials and tribulations. The depth of his work is reflected in the diversity of the teams, leaders, and coaches he has partnered with, including chairmen of boards, CEOs, entrepreneurs, corporate directors, professional athletes and coaches, sports teams, international organizations, public figures, and individuals. The list goes on and on from all walks of life. Ken Thaler, it's an honor. Welcome to my show.
Thank you, Dieter. It's absolutely great to see you again and be back in touch.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. Well, that I hope you liked that intro. There's so much to speak about with you. It might, you know, you have been in coaching in various ways for so many years. So I'm gonna really pick your brain about this. My audience is gonna be really interested about what you have to say. But you know, should we take this in German, this interview? Is that something you would really love to revisit? Or how is your Polish coming?
I can order beer in Polish. I have traveled an awful lot in my career since I left Austria, especially, but not that since I left hockey. I traveled more than I was traveling in hockey, and that took me out of Poland more than it kept me in Poland, and I haven't had that interface. Add on the fact that my wife is multilingual and talks readily when we're in public settings. If we go out and if it's in Polish, she jumps in before I have a chance to ask for explanation. And she's quite a competent lady, so I don't have to worry about things being done. I have to ask for, okay, please now translate it in English because it's faster.
Yeah, that's right.
It depends on what you want to do. My German, she's a German lady, so we speak German at home on occasion, but my German is my German, so English is certainly my best language of the three that I speak, so it's up to you.
Well, I'm gonna use your German on another podcast for German listeners in the future, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure.
But let's keep this in English. Well, please tell me a little bit about your journey, because you started coaching when you were quite young already as a head coach on university level. I think you were 28, 29, is that right?
26.
26.
In fact, I started getting paid for coaching when I was 16.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was coaching two teams. I mean, it was effectively a city program. And I coached two teams. The next year, I picked up another rink and coached four teams. And all of my teams made the semifinals, and they were playing against each other. So I had to get my assistant coaches to to pick one of the teams. And fortunately or unfortunately, one of the teams ended up getting beat out. And in the finals, I got to coach just one of the two teams and played against another team from another section of the city. So that was something. And then at the age of 21, I had a young man who now works with McKinsey, who I hired for summer placement in Austria. And so he started, I said, you know, he was a fantastic talent, and he now teaches leadership at their Leadership Academy, actually. And I told him he had a job anytime. He speaks about 11 languages now, and he's just a fantastic young man. And so he says, well, he was 21. He says, what were you like when you were 21? And I start telling him what I did, which I thought was perfectly normal. And what was perfectly normal for me was, at the age of 21, I was hired as the head coach of a minor lacrosse association. That's my other pro sport, by the way. There were 14 teams. There were 28 coaches, all coaches older than me. And I coached all the coaches, and I coached the coaches with their teams. So I prepared for them all of their year plans, their training plans, and I worked with them on the development of their teams. I was 21, and I thought, when I said that to him, I thought, that's rather unusual for somebody to do that. So I did that for a couple of years. In the summertime, whilst playing lacrosse in the area, that was down in Windsor, Ontario, in Canada, and that got me eventually. My hockey got me over to Europe, where again I coached the junior kids as I played pro for their team. And I never really left. When I went back to Windsor, actually, and did a master's in kinesiology, the coach there, who was a major. Major driver for coaching development in Canada, got a job at the Chinese national team in the second year. He asked me to be an assistant coach the first year, and I was happy because I got to train with the players and drink with the players because I was just assistant coach. So that was fun. So the next year he asked me to step in and take his place because he was off to China for a year. So I did. The unfortunate part was we had the best record that they'd had in over a decade. And he was coming back, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is not going to work, right? Because they weren't overly happy with the shift back. But meanwhile, I got a Canada Council Fellowship, allowed me to go to University of Montreal to work academically with a guy I wanted to work with at the outset, but stayed there to start my doctorate at Windsor in psychology, social psych. And stayed there because I got to coach the hockey club and do the doctorate at the same time and teach. So I did all three. It was a crazy year. Meanwhile, going to the University of Montreal, McGill had their coaching position open, so I took it. And I got to do the same thing again. I did the research and the academic development and then the coaching as well at McGill. Wow. So that got me rolling, and the McGill program actually did comparably what you have been doing, as you were mentioning the story we chatted about prior to you starting up the podcast, where you had set in some, you can call them simplistic rules, but critical, what you might call rules of life for the hockey program in Klagenfurt that after a while they finally accepted and integrated it into the way they do things, sort of like now the new Ka'atse way. And I did the same thing for McGill. And those things that I did for them in their culture, they are still doing. And it has brought, over the decades, it has brought their organization to the top, typically the top 4 to 6 of the whole country. Mm-hmm. So changing leadership culture through your coaching, the process of your coaching, and the basic principles that you follow and you implement, and the core values that you set up, they're absolutely critical to the culture that you want to have, which is very difficult to change once it's ingrained.
But how did you come up with those principles on such a young age? I mean, like being a coach or loving to be a coach, you know, with 21 or 16 even. Where does it come from?
Yeah, well, by the time I got to McGill, I was about 27 or 28. In fact, they gave me I should show you, it's in my wall of fame. I think I got you up there too, by the way.
Yeah, I hope so.
Some various pictures and whatnot. But they gave me a sweater with the number 27 on it and my name. And so that was my age when I first started coaching them. So I wasn't much older than the players. And quite frankly, it just came from within. It wasn't something that I'd thought about a lot. I'd studied kinesiology, but that basically was sports sciences. And I just started my doctorate work as I started coaching at McGill, which is in science, officially called Science of Sport, no, Science of Science de l'Activité Physique, Science of Physical Activity. But effectively, it was social psychology of sport performance, dealing with the team, dealing with individuals in the team, and dealing with teams versus teams. So that was my love, and that's how I coached. So I took those, I learned a lot, and I took those principles. And I did what effectively came naturally to me, quite honestly, and those were the guiding principles that I integrated. And then, just as you'd mentioned as well, I learned along the way. I had a few mentors that I didn't go to as much as I should have, and I didn't realize how valuable mentors were at the time, being quite an independent, feisty young man, and. But they helped me develop myself, which helped me develop the teams I was coaching. And so some of my self-learnings were critical to me being a better coach and me helping my teams be better because of that. And a lot of that was me getting out of the way of the players being successful.
Okay. So you talked about those mentors. There was a question that was on my mind too. Like, how do you see the role of a mentor now? Like I said, you should have gone to your mentors before. And I feel the same way. Many things. Yeah. My dad was telling me, you know, I see in a different light now as I'm a little older. But I guess everybody has to make the same, you know, your own mistakes. But how do you see the role of a mentor?
Well, quite frankly, what I really value now is when I see a young person understand the value of a mentor and go to them. And maybe they don't understand them. Maybe they go to them naturally. And it's possibly because of a mentoring relationship that they grew up under. And that gets us into other stuff. I'm actually doing some studies myself on psychogenealogy. Study of the impact of your ancestors on you, what you're carrying with them, and because of them, you can call it systemic family behavior as well. But it is about the genealogy, and so maybe it's because they had grandparents or parents, but typically grandparents, who were able to be a mentor for them quite naturally. That's what grandparents do. That allows them to naturally affiliate with other mentors. But if you don't do that, then you're learning those lessons in a much harder, harsher world, and you're not getting the kind word and the behaviors in particular that show you how to be more successful in doing what you're doing and being who you want to be, based on that, what I will call generational gap, that is very beneficial to learning how to deal with life. Mm-hmm. And so mentors are critically important, and you can see it in the successful people that you're aware of. And if you take, you know, probably the best publicized position in the world is the U.S. presidency. What's amazing is you take a look at the history of the presidents and you see the mentoring relationships that they had in their youth, and it's there. Okay, Bill Clinton's one of the key ones, and another very interesting one, despite his precocious personality, is Donald Trump. He went to a church religiously every week. And it was the pastor was integrated fully into his family life, and the pastor's name was Norman Vincent Peale. And I don't know if you know who that is, but no. He's the fellow who wrote the first book on the power of positive thinking. Mm-hmm. Way back when. And Donald Trump had this fellow in his house with regularity and listened to his sermons every week. So when you put that together with the impenetrable self-belief that this man has, and you see in the public eye regularly because he's so good at work in the media, you see how strong his inner sense of self is and his belief in what he's doing is. Now, whether you agree or don't agree with who he is and how he behaves, you do pick up that this man has been unbelievably successful in his life with respect to how he wants to be successful. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's due to the type of mentoring he got from a fellow with a renome of a Norman Vincent Peale. He's a classic and one of the first people to write in the school of positive psychology. Now, he didn't write as a positive psychologist. He wrote as a pastor, effectively.
Well, that goes to show that if you want to change something in your life, you know, make sure or be aware of the surroundings of the people that you surround yourself with, you know, the way they think, what they represent, what kind of aura they have, because you're picking up on that pretty quick, and it might go both ways, right?
Well, there you are. So if you want to start a movement, you need to realize that you as founder may be eventually adulated, okay? But it's all about the disciples that you bring around you. And I talked to you about this with respect to the cultural change that you had witnessed based on your work in the hockey club there. And I mentioned to you that it's actually that culture is complements of the people that you effectively recruited or that were attracted to you based on the work you were doing, because they're the ones who will exponentially spread out the word and the way of Dieter Kalt with their work. And so that's critical. Any major movement, you need the second wave of people to really make the birth a great birth and start expanding the movement like wildfire.
But please don't tell me that every great leader has to end up on a cross, you know, just to get this.
Well, indeed, that's the ultimate sacrifice, right? I mean, that's what makes that story great, is the ultimate sacrifice of giving your life for this makes it something that people are in awe of and have huge amount of respect for and are humbled by, because if you're willing to give your life for the cause, what greater gift could you give to the rest of the people?
That's deep stuff. It's deep stuff, Ken. Thank you very much. But, you know, coming back to coaching, your coaching journey didn't just stop at McGill. You came over to Europe.
Yeah.
To change Europe forever.
Well, actually, it was I don't know if I would say it that way. And when you're in the middle of something like that, you don't typically always see that either, right?
Yeah.
And it's certainly not that I did. I didn't have that much of an impact on it, as I see it, at least. Perhaps in Austria a little bit more than the other places. But, yeah, you still get it a little bit. I mean, I'm still in touch with the community of the first team I coached there. Albeit I don't think I did help them get a few more coaches into their club, but I don't think I did any major cultural changes in the clubs that I was with there, because I didn't stay very long.
But
I certainly learned an awful lot in my coaching career there. And it also, what was interesting is that I chose Europe as opposed to North America because I had two little kids at the time. And what you guys do, sorry, you guys,
yeah.
I've been here since 88 and I still say you guys. But what you do in Europe is you play two games a week typically, and you practice once to twice a day, especially back then. And that's basically what I did in university. Plus I taught, plus I researched. Okay. And so I was saying, boy, I don't have to teach, I don't have to research, I don't have to study, I just have hockey and I can spend all my time with my little girls. I had two little girls at the time. So I chose Austria after having asked a fellow who was coaching Vancouver Canucks at the time, who was an old friend of mine, and I asked him, his name was Tommy Watt. I said, Tommy, how many nights did you spend in your own bed last year? And he said, 72. Immediately, 72. He knew. He was 72 out of 365 days. And I said, thanks, Tommy. You helped me make my decision. Yeah. I had opportunities to go to a couple of clubs in North America. And at the time, I was going to Switzerland. At the time, actually, the financial arrangements were more or less in the same ballpark. They changed drastically, of course, as we headed into the 90s. Yeah. But back then, it was a good decision from a family perspective.
Okay.
And that's what got me over to Europe, and then I came to Austria.
yeah, and that's something that where I come into the picture, you know. And if you look back, the story of the Austrian national team on another level, it was playing over the past 20 years. You know, it's this time when you were there, it really sticks out. You know, it started something like a progression in Austrian hockey, being on playing on the highest international level. And then it suddenly stopped after, you know, a couple of years after you left, and we had a couple other good coaches. But then, you know, it's starting to decline, you know, being up and down. And then ever since that, you know, now we're up again, and they're trying to stay up in April, this coming World Championship. But how did you see the situation, you know, when you came to Austria?
Well, I mean, it was a great opportunity. And it's very funny because I taught advanced analysis of ice hockey at university there too, and of course I taught sports psychology and a bunch of other stuff. But my orientation when I was teaching at McGill was always international hockey, and the papers that the students had to hand in was usually based upon the World Championships. Okay, they had to take a team and analyze the team. And I was doing that before I came over to Europe, of course. And interestingly enough, if you know the coach that you didn't have, but he was my predecessor at in Austria, then we ultimately had him walk out of the arena when we beat, if you remember this, we beat Great Britain 10-0, and that eliminated his team from getting into the playoffs. And that's the year that we met. We met Finland in the quarterfinals, okay?
I remember.
Ludwig Bukas, he just passed away a couple days ago, huh?
Yes. Yeah. Ludwig
Bukas,
yeah.
Anyway, so I came in there and I was delighted to have the opportunity. And my boss, interesting, I'll just tell you this piece before telling you about the sort of the culture I saw when I came in. But we were playing the Soviet Union. Well, they were called Russia by that time, too, because it had to be 91. And my boss, whose name happens to be the same name as yours, but with a senior at the end of it, stood beside me as the players were going out, about to go out for warm-up. And he said to me, "Ken, I bet you never, ever thought you'd be playing against the Russians." And I had an immediate response. I said, "Dieter, I've been preparing for this my whole life."
Yeah.
And and I had. And then I went into the dressing room and told the players this is the best. They'd never beaten Russia or the Soviet Union. Yeah. And I told the players that this was the best opportunity for them to finally beat Russia. That they'll ever have, at least up until this point. And they didn't believe me. It was clear they didn't believe me. And after the first period, if I remember correctly, after the first period, it was 2-0 for us. And after you remember this? Were you playing
yes.
then?
Yes.
After the second period, it was 3. And my players, when we came back in, my players looked at me sort of questioningly and, you know, didn't really think, oh, this is pretty good. We had a great first period, but, like, you know, it's not really real.
Yeah.
And at the end of the second period, it was 3-2 for us. Okay? And we got back into the dressing room, and everybody was really excited. Like, holy shit, Ken, you're right. We have a chance. It's really possible. And I thought, oh, God, it's unfortunate. But I know, boys, because you didn't believe in the first period, unfortunately, this is going to slip away from you. And the end of the game, it was 7-3. Not for us. And I knew that was coming. And, I mean, I'd analyzed the team, and I knew what Tikhonov was doing, who was actually one of my mentors. I'll tell you that later.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what he was doing. I knew he was not playing his best five. I knew he had driven the living daylights out of these guys, and they really didn't want to play this game.
Yeah.
And I also knew that the game was also a bit of a favor for the Federation.
Yeah.
And it was just an add-on to their intensive training program for the World Championships. So I knew we had a great opportunity here. And they didn't believe that. But we ultimately got our win, if I remember correctly, 1-0 in Zell am Zee.
Yes, I remember that game too.
Yeah. Again, they killed us if I remember right, they killed us in the World Championships. But we got our win from them, which was pretty special for us to be able to do, because we were not a country that had an awful lot of hockey players, and we were not a country that had an elite approach to hockey development.
Yes.
And that's what I tried to instill there. Same stuff that you talked about is instilled. And that's why I went out to every club and I talked with all their coaches and I talked with all their leadership. And I talked about the culture of their organization. I talked about the coaching certification program, and I led that all the time to try and initiate some changes. And I also told them this is a 10-year process. Okay, and I also sat on the, not sat, I was on the ice with young people such as Thomas Fanick. Yeah. Okay, if you recall, he was the first major star to go through, and he was the first major player who came in as a talent in Europe or in Austria, who went through Austria till he was 14 before he headed out.
Yes.
And so it was trying to get the competitive structure in such a way that you weren't getting blowouts, because you guys especially from Klagenfurt where you came from and are living now, it was typical for you to be accustomed to win a game 10-15-0, 8-0. And it was a mistake to let them score a goal often. And the other team on the other side, because I went to all the organizations, they were accustomed to being killed that much. So, how do you develop top talents when you don't give them a competitive opportunity? Okay. And so that was one of the biggest things that I got implemented. And it started in, what was the youngest level there in juniors?
Under 11?
I think it was the next level up, what you would call peewee in international.
Because it's 14, under 14 then.
Now it is, 16, yeah. Back then it 14, might not 16. Have been. No, no, it was 13 if I remember correctly, because you got to go to the Quebec tournament.
So
I had two objectives. I wanted to get them to change the competitive structure so that they were obliged to go up, do Aufstieg, Abstieg.
Yeah.
Okay, and to get more regional representation. And then I also wanted Austria to get national teams that were bona fide national teams all the way down to that level if possible and get them to go to that Quebec Pee-wee tournament. And that produced a superstar of that tournament, because it happened faster than I thought it was going to happen, who almost broke the Wayne Gretzky number of goals scored at that time, Greg Baumgartner. I think he was a former teammate of yours.
Yes, yes.
And and he ended up going over and having a good shot at hockey over there too before he came back and played in Switzerland. But that got some profiling as to what Austria could do at that age level, and that was critical to create waves of players looking to perform at a higher level than what they had at the local club level. And so when you do, I don't know where we're going with all this, but when you talk about that, what a coach who thinks long term does is he works on the culture.
Yeah, I totally agree. But it is a big difference in coaching national teams than it is to coach on a club level. Don't you think? The approach.
Yes and no. The principles are still the same. The stress levels are what differs. Okay, you've got your club teams on a daily basis, so you can work with daily behavior. Okay, you've got entitlement and ownership situations which are different. You don't have what you don't have that the national teams have is the aura of playing for your country. I mean, and what a great motivation that is, or should be, okay? And so that's the opportunity you get for that. It's also you going to the national team as a feather in your cap in terms of saying, hey, you're one of our best. And so everybody likes to be able to be that, okay? The question is, how much struggle and how much competition do you create at the club level, at the league level, in order to make that a bigger honor? Okay, mm-hmm. And so the club level, you've got the daily stresses. It's also the same kind of thing when you talk about, and I thought you were going to head there, when you talk about coaching in a corporation versus coaching in a sport.
Yes, that's something I want to get to
There's a difference there. You've got a more intensive opportunity on a daily basis to work with athletes developmentally. You don't have that opportunity with a national team. You got to take what you get. And you can develop the team as they work together, but you can't change how a player really plays. You can only try and help them adapt into a system that is adaptive to their skills and talents. Okay.
Yeah, but at the same time, how I saw the national team, it's a short term success is possible with group dynamics, a lot more than with the team that you work with the whole year, and you get players that have a great time, have a great success in their team, and then they come to the national team and spend a great week. But oftentimes you get some guys who are like in a down phase, and they're like, okay, now it's time to relax. This is going to be fun. It's going to be great competition. So everybody comes with a positive attitude, which is beneficial for the coaching staff as well. At the same time, you need to produce results really quickly, and one day goes wrong, and you have the game the next day, and then you just you start a tournament with a bad game, and you might be in trouble.
Yeah, that's feasible. So developing positive group dynamics at the very start for a national team is really critical, and creating a situation where in actuality, especially with the level we were playing at back then. In actuality, you had to not help them relax, per se, or sort of let down a guard. You had to get them to realize they had to step up, because the level at which they had to play was a level they hadn't played their whole year. Okay, yeah. And then they also had to play with guys they were beaten up on just the day before, okay, or a week before in tournaments. And so you could work on those dynamics there, but you also had to shock the people into the level of intensity they needed to have, the level of focus that they needed to have in order for them not to have a bad first day. Because you're absolutely right. If you start off a tournament in a bad way, it's really, really difficult in such a short time to transform that momentum into a positive momentum.
So what is if I want to take it to a personal level, because I was one of the young guys on the team, and if I look back, and my personal situation, I was always the son of, my dad used to be the manager of the team, and then he used to be the president of the federation for many years, and of course I got everything for free my whole life. But the truth is, it was just the opposite. But now that I'm a coach and I was a manager of a professional team, what you did, taking an 18-year-old to play in the first A-level world championship in the history of the country, and then that was and if I remember correctly, one guy you cut at the end was the actual captain of the national team back then.
Yeah, so at the B level. Yeah.
And making that decision as a coach who's just, coming new to a country, how did you have the balls to do that? Excuse my French, please. But what?
I absolutely loved Austrian beer. And I needed the blessing of my boss. I mean, I was going to do it, but I needed the blessing of my boss, otherwise, or risk being fired that night then too. And when I told him what I wanted to do the night before, we were actually out at dinner sitting beside each other with the whole team. And it took him most of the dinner and a lot of beer before he turned around and said, Ken, if I'm honest with you, you're absolutely spot on. And I said, thank you, Dieter. You've just made my tournament. And so that was a big, that was a huge step, because it's clear. Not, you forget, this was a B tournament we had to win, okay? He didn't get cut. He didn't get cut from the A team. He got cut from the B team, okay, which in every other year he would have easily made.
Yeah.
And the other kicker on that was that that was in his hometown. That tournament was in his hometown. So I was, here's this upstart young coach coming in. Well, I wasn't so young at the time, I guess. I was a little bit older. Still in my 30s, if I remember right. Anyways, coming in, nobody knew him from a hole in the ground, and didn't have an international reputation per se, and came in and said, well, it looks like my last cut's going to be the captain of the local team where we're hosting the tournament. Okay. Yeah. Do you think we got headlines?
Yeah.
We certainly did. But it had an impact, because and I don't want to talk about all the ifs, ands, and buts about why that decision was made. But it was in my opinion, for what I wanted for this team, it was absolutely the most appropriate decision. It also got everybody clicking their heels, standing up straight, and saying, "Okay, good. We know who's in charge of the ship."
Yes.
And that was absolutely critical for me to be able to do, because otherwise, especially in that that region, in that town, to be in charge of the ship was extremely difficult. And I do believe you've experienced some of that yourself.
Yes.
And,
yes,
I do. So I had to do that to hit it with a hammer and everybody else pay attention, because this fellow who's great, he was a great guy, and you know, I felt bad with respect to that. I also felt bad with some of the other guys. Well, I feel bad with everybody I cut, but you cut them because you've got to do that. So you've got to be able to dissociate yourself. You can't be so compassionate as to make a decision that takes you away from performance, and that's a key factor. And that was a performance decision. It was, quite frankly, it was a performance decision. It was not based on who he was. It was not based on the fact he was captain, and it was not based on the fact that he was coming from Klagenfurt. It was a performance decision, and it was a team performance decision, not an individual one. He did not and was not able to adapt to fit into what I wanted to have the team play and as a system. And I knew that I had bigger battles to win on the team, and that I had to get some other players in to toe the line. And if I didn't, and that was another part, because he was also part of the older guard. Yeah. And we had to have a shift if we were going to truly get into the A level, as they called it back then, and to qualify for the, be able to qualify for the Olympics, which we did too. And so that was, yeah, you're right. That was a critical decision that helped me have a few good years with that organization.
Yeah, no, well, that's true. Especially, you know, if I look at my personal situation, you know, I got the chance to play on this high level at a very young age.
Yeah.
And I want to believe I deserve that, you know, because of the performance, you know, and please don't tell me otherwise. No, but you know, it jumped start my international career. If I wouldn't have been able to play on an international level back in the days, you know, as an Austrian, I would have never had the chance to play for international teams and have the career that I had, you know. So and that needed a coach that saw something in me and not only seeing something in me, but taking a risk and making a big decision for, you know, for a national team, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely no question. And I also, one of the things I do as a coach is hold a bigger vision for yourself, for the athlete or for the client, than what they themselves even realize is possible for them. I typically always do that. And I did that with you. What you may or may not know is the fight I had with journalists who were quite keen on saying that this was a political decision.
Yes.
And I was extremely irate with them, and I really beleaguered them with my 25 words of German at the time to tell them that there was absolutely no chance that the Verbandskapitän or the general manager of the team had a say in who I chose for the team. That was my decision, nobody else's. And I was pretty harsh with some of them with respect to that very decision. And interestingly enough, we've talked about two decisions that were independent of each other, yet very dependent upon each other. Because I had done what I'd done the year before with the captain of the local team in my first year there, which was, I mean, people would look at it, as you say, and wonder, how the hell did the guy do that? Well, okay, I did that, and it let everybody know who was calling the shots on the personnel, on the players. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then I decided on taking a young man like yourself because of what I saw in you and your readiness. That was one of the key factors, and not just readiness with respect to ability to play. It was also emotional and social readiness. Because, you know, you also have a name on the back of your sweater, which is a heavy load for you. And you were going to have that during that tournament, too. And I knew that. Okay. And one of the first things that had to happen is you had to come in with as clean a slate as you possibly could. So, and that's what I did when I set that up. And I made that decision and put that out into the public and then defended it quite ferociously that was a coach's decision and nobody else's. So, yeah.
Well, that's a huge message for any coach listening to this, you know, because there's a lot of political decisions going on in sports and everywhere, and that was something in my personal career too, you know, that I was I knew it was going to come. Where you draw the line, you know, where you really stand up for your beliefs, And where do you start bending over, or, you know, finding compromise to justify that, okay, you know, I got to secure what I have, you know, for my family and everything? Or where do I say, okay, you know, this much I can do. And if I have to bend over backwards, then, you know, do it without me. And that situation came for me too. And it was unbearable. And the coach I worked with before, my first professional stint as a coach, assistant coach and a pro team, talking about the second, we won the championship the first time, I told you know that. And the second year, you know, after the second year, the head coach who just won the championship got fired. and talking about everything that happened, he said, you know, some things, you know, I hate myself more than anything, because I did not do what I believed in at certain times, you know?
Boom. Yeah. Boom. So there you go. I call it the mirror test. Mm-hmm. Okay. You've got to be able to look yourself in a mirror every day and be happy with what you've decided to do. Okay. And be happy with who you are to yourself. In other words, be true to yourself. And if you can't do that, you know what decisions you need to make. All right. That's absolutely critical if you're going to be the kind of coach you want to be, and if you want to have the kind of impact you'd love to have on the people that you're coaching. Okay. And if you can't do that, it's time to walk away.
And it's so true, because at the end of the day, you know, professional coaching, chances are you're going to get fired anyways, you know, sooner or later. You know,
it's the exception that you don't get fired. Of course, that was one of Tikhonov's. I got fired. It took a while for me to get fired, but I finally got fired from a club. We were coaching in the European League, and so he chuckled. He says, "How many times you fired?" And I said, "Well, it's only the first time." He says, "Well, you're still not a professional coach then." I've been coaching for decades, and he said to be a professional coach, you have to be fired three times. And then he told me the three envelope joke. You know that one? Yeah, you got to be fired three times.
Yeah,
and
then, no.
And you know the three envelope joke?
No.
Okay,
no,
so he came. So he came into the office, new job, coaching, and on his desk were three envelopes, and they are apparently from the previous coach. And so the first envelope said, "Upon your first crisis, open this envelope and read it." And the second one said the same thing, but it was upon the second crisis, and of course upon the third crisis, opened this envelope. So he was doing pretty good. He started up pretty good. The year went well, but then he had a bit of a down in November, and there was getting to be a lot of pressure, and he was thinking, okay, good, you know what, I'm going to go to the, he just stuffed them into his drawer at his desk, and so he said, I'm going to go and open that first envelope. So he opened up the first envelope, and he read it, and it just had one sentence that says, "Blame it on me." In other words, the previous coach. So I thought, okay, I'm going to blame it on the previous coach. And he did, and he got away, and he kept on going. They picked up, and they did pretty good. But then come the end of January, he got into another crisis and was having some difficulties. And he thought, oh, gosh, I'm getting so close. So he said, I'm going to go to that second one. So they got into the second envelope and opened it up, and it said one line only. It says, "Blame it on the players." So he blamed it on the players, and the players picked it up, and they accepted responsibility, and they kept going, and you know, the season was moving along pretty good, but they were heading towards the playoffs, and they were getting into trouble, and they weren't winning, and it didn't look like they were going to make it. So he thought, oh man, I'm going to have to open up that third envelope. It's just not working well here, so I've got to get real inspiration. So he opens up the third envelope, and it says, "Prepare three envelopes."
Yeah, strike three.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening to part one of my interview with Ken Tyler, the Olympic coach and business consultant. I hope you've enjoyed the show. And if that is the case, don't hesitate to leave a comment, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, or all the other platforms. I would really appreciate you taking the time to leave a short review and support me on my mission. You can also find me on social media. Just look for @74 once more on Facebook or Dieter Kalt 74 on Instagram, hashtag 74 once more. Thank you very much again, and part two of the interview coming up very soon, so stay tuned.